City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, a power-packed hour. We're going to be speaking in a half hour with a man who says that virtually all genetic engineering in the United States, in the way of our food, is illegal. He is a public interest attorney and founder of the Alliance for Biointegrity, a nonprofit that advances human and environmental health through sustainable and safe technologies. He is also the instigator of a major and little-known lawsuit against the U.S. FDA over the approval of GMOs in violation of federal safety codes. And although my guest, Stephen Drucker, and other plaintiffs in the scientific and religious communities lost the suit, it nevertheless resulted in the release of thousands, tens of thousands of pages from the FDA files proving illegal wrongdoing in favor of the biotech industries, and specifically Monsanto. So today, in an exclusive interview from Iowa, the U.S. government's blatant violations and criminal activity of the federal food safety regulations and corruption at every level, permeating everything to doing with GMOs. Please let your friends who care about passing the proposition in California to label genetically engineered foods, let them know we're doing this show. People want to hear this. They have not heard this before. We try to bring you cutting-edge material. I will continue with the commentary on why don't Americans care about democracy at home. It is my contention that the important issues are virtually never discussed and never brought up. And you may ask why, and the answer, I think, is simple. I will refer back to the father of Gestalt psychology, who said, "A fear of knowing is a fear of doing." And I recall when I sent out a very important article that had taken 5 years, full-time, for five of us, all MDs and PhDs, all scientists, all published in peer-reviewed literature. We worked on it together. It was called Death by Medicine. And in it, we used only peer-reviewed literature findings, none of our own. There was no suppositions. There was nothing subjective. And we found that the number one cause of death in the United States was American medicine itself, as well as the number of injured, American medicine. The numbers dwarfed all those who died of heart attacks, strokes, cancer, diabetes. And yet, even though the Journal of the American Medical Association ran a big article on it, they put it at number three. It was interesting. They left out statistics, which either shows extraordinarily negligence and sloppiness, and they should not be allowed to get away with that because they have unlimited millions of dollars to hire the best researchers to make sure that's not done. They left out bed sores. Well, that's 88,000 people dying in a given year in hospitals from bed sores. They left out deaths from malnutrition. They left out other types of death from infections. We didn't. We only used their statistics. The important point of this is that we sent this out to 7,000 individuals. It was the largest mailing of an article I'd ever done. Every single one of the media in America got it. Every scientific journal in the United States that we could find got it. Every member of Congress got it. The FDA commissioner got it. We sent it to the White House. We sent it to the Health and Human Services. We sent it to Harvard and MIT. Every place we could think of, we sent it. Not a single person responded. Not one. Every editor at the New York Times, New York Post, Washington Post, Philadelphia Inquirer, San Francisco Chronicle, Los Angeles Times, all the major papers, all got it. Not a word. Why? I believe, and this is subjective, but I believe that had anybody even give legitimacy to the concerns we had, it would have opened up a door and everything else would have poured out of it. So they simply denied the existence of anything that's a problem in medicine. So it doesn't affect the hundreds of billions of dollars in profits made by those who end up at the end of the year having more money in their corporate accounts, greater value in their stocks, no matter how many Americans are toe-tagged and buried, and all this is hidden. So I believe we're doing the same today. It is my belief, and I will articulate it in a commentary, that we are in complete denial of all the important issues and how to approach our problems and our solutions. Commentary also, Henry Giroux, Truth Out. Also today, if time permits, Grant Glenn Greenwald, commentary from The Guardian of what happens when you do not do anything that's wrong, but you end up with 3 years in prison because you become an embarrassment to the administration for having been right. And I'll give you that. Also, some scary new malware targets Android phones. They're stealing your images. They're reconstructing rooms in your house, even when your phone is off. This is where they're going with your technology. So no matter where you go, they know where you're at, what you're saying, what you're doing, who you're doing it with, what you're talking about. You didn't know that. You will today. I don't know the time will permit, but if it does, quote, we are now 1 year away from global riots, and complex systems theorists say, with collapsing, a separate article that ties into it, quote, world food prices impact by U.S. drought, and that is causing famine, and that is causing starvation. A lot's happening. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. On the subject of health and nutrition, I go to the scientific peer review literature every day to try to get you stuff that you're not going to have in your mainstream newspapers. This comes from the peer review journal Neurology and from the American Academy of Neurology. The mother's high blood pressure, which so many women in the United States, they have high blood pressure, in pregnancy can affect your child's IQ later in life. I'll quote this. New research suggests a mother's high blood pressure during pregnancy may have an effect upon her child's thinking skills all the way into old age. Quote, high blood pressure and related conditions such as preeclampsia complicate about 10% of all pregnancies and can affect a baby's environment in the womb. This is from the University of Helsinki in Finland. Quote, our study suggests that even declines in thinking, though at least in old age, could have originated during the prenatal period when the majority of the development of the brain structure and function occurs. And in women with high blood pressure, this is statistically significant. So what's the takeaway message? The takeaway message is if you are planning a pregnancy or if you are pregnant, lower your blood pressure through natural non-toxic means. Without being aware of it, you'd be helping your child be able to think better, have better memory, better cognitive skills. That's the latest science. Now, for something to help all of you who have any form of liver dysfunction, especially diabetics who are very susceptible to liver dysfunction, from the Journal of the American the Medical Association of Thailand comes an article about curcumin. Now, keep in mind, this is a very powerful polyphenol-rich herb. It comes from the turmeric, and then from turmeric, they extract their curcumin. And here's what it says, quote, the curcumin is capable of repairing and even regenerating the liver tissue in this experiment. So that's very important. This was done at the University of Bangkok and where curcumin was used. Now, once again, I suggest that individuals use curcumin on a daily basis because not only does it have hepatoprotective properties, but there are 30 other studies that I found on him helping people who have liver fibrosis. Then I found 78 studies separately, all from peer reviewed literature, that it protects the liver overall. Then I found 5,100, you heard me right, 5,100 studies in peer reviewed literature about what it does to protect us if we have cancer cells forming, or you have cancer, or you have all these other toxins, or you have heavy metals. So it's simply a superstar. Let's get it into our body. It's extremely beneficial. It helps you with diabetic complications and diabetic neuropathy. Millions have that. And So let's get our curcumin. Now, I went down to Pittsburgh to do a public television station program. I got all these calls afterwards about people who wanted to know about losing weight. And I had been reading on the plane down the latest statistics about how fat Americans are. And it so happens that people in the Pittsburgh area are right at the top of the list in that whole Allegheny area. And that means West Virginia, Pennsylvania, much of Ohio, and they're very overweight. Then you have to go down south. Then I went on down to Atlanta, and I was on recently a PBS station there. And they have, I think they're in the top five. Then you go over to New Orleans, anywhere in Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Arkansas, that's your highest in the United States. So I went through this area talking to the people and also filming. And I was just amazed. And a person said to me, if you really want to see what Americans are like, do two things. Go to a very upscale shopping area downtown where mainly younger people go, then go to Walmarts. Go to both, because the upscale people generally don't shop at Walmarts, nor the Walmarts people go downtown. So I thought it was good advice, and that's what I did. I spent a day just sitting and watching people, and wherever possible asking a few questions at both Walmart and downtown. And this person was right. The people downtown who were younger and college grads, they tend to be leaner, healthier. The ones shopping at Walmart tend to be overweight. But the percentages were just astronomical. I found, just from looking at people, and keep in mind, I've done a lot of body mass index testing with impedance machines on tens of thousands of people. I'm pretty good at guessing people's body fat. But ideally, if you're a man, you want to be around 10 to 12%. A woman, 12 to 15%. That's the ideal, in my opinion. But you got to work out to get there. In other words, you have to lift weights, resistance exercise, and aerobic. And then you'll burn all that extra fat out and keep what your body needs and get rid of the rest. Because the more you get rid of, the less your likelihood of a heart attack, a stroke, cancer, depression. That's what happens when you're overweight. Here's the latest study. Thought I'd share this just to keep this in perspective. From USA Today, quote, the percentage of American adults who are 100 pounds or more overweight has skyrocketed. Quote, now this is how many people are morbidly obese. That means so severely obese that they're lucky to be alive. 15.5 million. Whoa. 15.5 million people are morbidly obese. Quote, there is no question that severe obesity is going up very fast. Severe obesity has severe effects on quality of life, chronic conditions, and health care cost. You also increase your risk of diabetes, heart disease, cancer substantially. Now, here's what it's interesting. He says, but now we have two-thirds of all Americans are either overweight or obese. Two-thirds. Well, now you're up to 200 million Americans. 200 million. What's being done about it? Where do we have a president or surgeon general or anyone coming up and telling us? We don't and we can't. They could do something like, let's eat better and exercise. That's safe. But they're never going to tell you the truth. The truth is they would alienate their sponsors, their donors. They're not going to do that. So this year, starting in December, I'm starting a national effort to educate people about why we're fat and what we can do to lose weight in a healthy way without the crash diets. I'm outfitting a RV. I'm going to put documentaries in every town I can and take a trip across the United States and give out free literature, hold lectures, give information to people, help get them started with some local health support groups in their communities, because it's time that we got this fat off. Mainstream media ignores the benefits of antioxidants. This is from Dr. Michael Smith. And here's what he says. We're not interested in antioxidants in the United States. In a recent study examining 32,000 women, they found that an antioxidant-rich diet, including intake of fruits and vegetables and whole grains, plays a role in preventing heart attacks. And so that's good, right? Then it also says, according to the American Journal of Medicine, one of the most respected journals, they published the findings from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden showing a reduced risk of heart attacks in women following a diet rich in antioxidants or taking antioxidants. And now, for the first time, I'm seeing this ORAC. Now, this audience knows that ORAC, oxygen radical absorption capacity, in foods helps protect your cells, because the more antioxidants you have in your body, the more those are going to trap the free radicals. The free radicals are what injure your cell, and your injured cells what causes cancer or other physical conditions. So they studied 32,000 women, and they found that those who had the highest ORAC, or highest oxygen radical absorption capacity, or antioxidants, were the ones who were the healthiest, had the least disease. And then they asked the women to keep diaries, and they found there was a big reduction in heart attacks compared to the women who had the least antioxidants. Well, that was a very valuable study. Now ask yourself, how many women eat antioxidant-rich foods in the United States versus how many eat antioxidant-depleted foods? Hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, pastas, pizzas, bread. Those don't have antioxidants in them. But they do have pro-inflammation, which causes free radicals, which further accelerate and increase your risk. And that's why you have one-third of American adults obese or overweight. And that means the body is flooded with antioxidants. So quite simply, they're killing themselves with their fork. So get your antioxidants. The more juices you drink, the more fruits and vegetables and grains and sprouts you eat, the more supplements you take that are antioxidant, the longer you're going to live. And finally, lycopene, of course, comes from tomatoes and watermelon and pink grapefruit and papaya, mainly things that are red. And it's a unique chemical structure. It's a bright red carotene. Now they're finding that it helps prevent against ultraviolet skin damage. Now we know that the skin's damaged by the sun rays. When you get too much of it, you start to lose your tone and elasticity. Unfortunately, then you end up with crow's feet and deep wrinkles, and you get that jowiness. Well, according to a new study from Mount Sinai School of Medicine, they looked at lycopene's protective properties against the ultraviolet radiation when applied to the skin, and they found that a critical skin enzyme was activated by lycopene that protects you from the most important part of a skin cell, its DNA. So in effect, lycopene repairs the skin's cell's DNA, and that is good. It reduces inflammation and allows normal cell proliferation and prevents DNA damage. So if you want to have healthier skin, you got to protect your collagen, and the collagen is impacted by lycopene. All that is good. So let's get our tomato juice. And a great way to have tomato juice is simply to get some organic tomatoes. And the way you buy a tomato is simple. Most of the commercial tomatoes in the United States are picked green, put into boxes. The boxes can then have a spray, a gas, that they're given in a big container or in a big storage locker. And that artificially stimulates enzyme activity. That's also one of the reasons they're tasteless. Have you ever noticed you can put a tomato, a fresh organic tomato, out on a counter right beside, try this as an experiment, and then buy a grocery store purchase non-organic tomato. Have them side by side. Do the same thing with a peach and a plum. What do you want to bet within 3 days to 5 days the organic tomato is starting to get little white cracks in it. Mold is forming, and it's lost its desire to be eaten. Now look at the one that's not organic, because it was frequently irradiated, and it was harvested immature and gassed, it doesn't rot. It shrivels, but it doesn't rot. But it's also tasteless, and it's mealy inside. So when, let's say you go out and you have a peach tree, and you want to harvest a peach, always put your hand underneath the peach and gently push up. And if you feel it heavy in your hand, it's ready to be harvested. If not, don't harvest it, because that means that the fruit through the photosynthesis is still creating natural sugars. And it needs water and sunlight and the minerals to do that. And that way you get the juiciest fruit. And that's also how you should be picking your tomatoes. Tomatoes shouldn't be firm. They should have a slight pliability to them. And that way you get your best tomatoes. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're always talking about issues that make a difference. Now to our environmental segment. I want to share two things. First, this comes from Greenpeace, and they're giving us one more reason to contact Governor Cuomo to encourage him to ban fracking now. I'll quote this. New York's clean drinking water is at risk. The natural gas industry is using a destructive process called hydraulic fracking, or fracking, throughout Pennsylvania and other states to get to the natural gas reserves buried deep within the shale rock deposits underground. Well, fracking is dangerous because the toxic chemicals they will pump into the ground to extract the natural gas could leak into our water supply. I've seen people end up with drinking water so toxic it is flammable. Now the industry is trying to bring this threat to New York. We have a chance to stop this. Governor Cuomo has been feeling the heat from New Yorkers that are not happy about the possible threat to their clean water. So the governor decided to buy some time by saying his administration would conduct a secret study on the public health impacts of opening New York to fracking. This is not good enough. We cannot trust an administration that has actively been pushing to bring fracking to New York to produce an unbiased study. Tell Governor Cuomo, no sham health studies, no more delays, ban fracking now. In order for Governor Cuomo to stop this, he needs to hear from all New Yorkers. The governor would cause a public health catastrophe if he opened New York to fracking. Each fracking gas well generates millions of gallons of toxic radioactive wastewater, which can spill and contaminate drinking water. Tell the governor that New Yorkers want to keep their clean water and that he needs to ban fracking now. This is from Carolyn Allwider, a Greenpeace field team. Thank you, Greenpeace, for doing that. We are constantly on the issue of fracking in New York, but for all of us, for WPFW audience in Washington, District of Columbia, West Virginia, Maryland, and Virginia, contact your governors and tell them the same. No hydrofracking. From KPFK, our friends in Los Angeles, that go clear up California. Tell the governor, Brown, no gas hydrofracking. Now, I'm sure many of you are as concerned as I am about what happens when you end up having people debate issues and they miss all the important points. I'd like to share some of the points that I believe should be addressed now. And if the current parties in power, the corporate Democrats and the corporate Republicans, are not willing to debate any of these issues or invite knowledgeable, progressive third-party candidates from the Green Party, Jill Stein, from the Justice Party, any of the other parties out there, the Libertarian Party, bring them on and let them share their points of view, Rocky Anderson and the others. But they're not doing that, because these people would be just about the opposite on every single important issue. How does this happen? How do we have it that only a handful of programs in all the United States are really dealing with the issues that matter to us? In my opinion, in addition to amassing ever-expanding amounts of material wealth, the rich now control the means of schooling and education in the United States. They have disinvested in critical education. Now, as a school teacher for my entire adult career, this is something that's important to me. And yet, in return, while they disinvest in real education, critical education, they are reproducing notions of common sense that incessantly replicate the basic values and ideas and relations necessary to sustain the institutions of economic Darwinism. Both parties support educational reforms that increase conceptual illiteracy. We're actually making our students dumber. Critical learning is now reduced to mastering test-taking, memorizing facts, and learning how not to question knowledge and authority. Now, this type of rote power, as Zygmunt Bauman pointed out, is the most effective prescription for grinding communications to a halt and for robbing it of the presumption and expectation of meaningfulness and sense. When you and I were growing up as baby boomers, were we given coaches and tutors and given what the test would be and then given constant hours of attention so we could just pass a test but have absolutely no knowledge of the context of that question in the test, how it would implicate us in making a proper or improper decision in life? Absolutely not. Because we had public education that was preparing us to be good citizens and also how to question authority. This type of market-driven illiteracy has eviscerated the notions of freedom, turning it largely into the desire to consume and invest exhaustively and exclusively in relationships that serve only one individual interest, your own. Almost everything today is about me. What is in my interest? Citizens are treated by the political and economic elite as restless children, and are invited daily to convert the practice of citizenship into the art of shopping. Shallow consumerism, coupled with an indifference to the needs and suffering of others, has produced a politics of disengagement and a culture of moral irresponsibility. Language has been stripped of the terms, phrases, and ideas that embrace a concern for the other. And isn't it time that we cared about each other? How can you possibly not care about those who suffer? 18 million children go to bed hungry in the United States. 50 million Americans are on food stamps, but 100 million Americans are at poverty or below. We've had 44 million Americans who've been forced out of their homes, and now we have another 40 million who will lose their homes because their home's mortgage is underwater. The value of their mortgage is higher than the value of their home. Do we care about these people as our neighbors? Do we go over and say, neighbor, what can I do to help you? Do we care about all the senior citizens who sit alone each day in their homes without friends, without resources, just waiting to die? What happens to us when we stop caring about each other? And yet, I see no care on the part of the powerful in Washington, in the agencies, in the bureaucracies, bloated, corrupt, metastasized as they become, self-serving. I don't see that. And we should. With meaning utterly privatized, words are reduced to signifiers that mimic spectacles of violence. We've all seen this, the designed violence to provide entertainment. How can we be entertained by violence? We need thoughtful analysis. Sentiments circulating in the dominant culture parade either idiocy or survival of the fittest ethic, while anti-public rhetoric strips society of the knowledge and values necessary for the development of a democratically engaged and socially responsible public. In such circumstances, freedom has truly morphed into its opposite. Neoliberal ideology has construed as pathological any notion that in a healthy society, people depend upon each other in multiple, complex, direct, and indirect ways. As Louis Laffan points out, citizens are no longer held in thoughtful regard, just as thinking and acting are removed from acts of public conscience. Economic Darwinism has produced a legitimizing ideology in which the conditions for critical inquiry and moral responsibility and social and economic justice disappear. The result is that neoliberal ideology increasingly resembles a call to war that turns the principles of democracy against democracy itself. Americans now live in an atomized and pulverized society, spattered with the debris of broken inner human bonds, in which democracy becomes a perishable commodity, and all things public, that which we all grew up with, that which we all valued, are viewed now with disdain. What about our public parks? What about our public water? What about our public air? Why have we not said anything when these have been privatized? The result is that neoliberal ideology increasingly resembles the worst of all human nature, and all things public then are cast aside. Increasingly, it appears the only bond holding Americans tied together is a perverse collective death drive. As the level of governance in neoliberalism has turned politics into a tawdry form of money laundering in which the spaces and registers that circulate power are controlled by those who have amassed large amounts of capital, elections, the perversity, the absurdity, the decadency of this current facade, it represents nothing but the wanton pedigree of those who are powerful enough to mock us at every level by buying candidates. And please remember this, and I will keep saying this until you are tired to death of it, but none of our politicians at the higher level are ever elected. They are selected by those in power, groomed to obey the principles, to act their part, to be rewarded dutifully for that. And then they are sold to the American public, packaged. And therefore it is their smile. It is what they resonate in their humor and personality, the quick retort. If you call this radio station and ask me a question, I must use my resources in this moment to answer it, and you will either hear me competent or incompetent, clear or unclear, conscious or unconscious in this moment. Mr. President pretend and Mr. President wannabe, when was the last time you ever in your lives answered a direct, honest question that was not given by one of your supplicant media whores, where you actually ask a relevant question and had no 100 individuals grooming you for an answer, taking you off to a location and preparing you? My God, that's what we want our actors on Broadway to do. We want them to read their lines and then memorize them and then share them with us fluently and effortlessly. But that's what we now expect of our politicians. What if someone stepped on a button and the curtain pulled back and suddenly we see hundreds of people saying, answer this way, don't answer that way, look this way, don't look down, look up, smile, don't smile. This is what you say. Then what is this charade about? Who then are the fools? In the Senate and the House of Representatives, 47% are millionaires. The estimated value of worth of the average U.S. senator is $2.56 million, while the median net worth of members of Congress is $913,000. So I ask you, our elected representatives no longer do the bidding of the people who elect them. If we did, we would have clean water. We would have clean air. We would have no nuclear power plants. We would have no gas hydrofracking. We would have no genetically modified foods. We would have no urban sprawl. We would have no home foreclosures. We would have no bank bailouts of Wall Street. We would have no Federal Reserve. We would have no IRS. How many things would we not have if we truly listened to the people? We would have no wars. We would not be engaged in imperial overdrive throughout the world and then wonder, why do they hate us? You think that maybe it's because of our actions on them and supporting their abusive administrations for so many decades? You think that maybe the impartiality of how we have dealt with many of them and the extreme partiality in Israel and Palestine, you think that maybe that might be a reason? Rather, what we now see is we see those we've elected largely influenced by the demands of lobbyists who have enormous clout in promoting the interest of the elite, financial services, and mega corporations. Currently, there are more than 14,000 registered lobbyists in Washington, but there is triple that in non-registered consultants. That means you have 100 people influencing every member of Congress. How much do they spend? Officially, it's $3.3 billion. That's official. Unofficial, probably three times that amount. But why quibble? $3 billion can make them $300 billion in return. Bill Moyers and Bernard Weisberg succinctly put it, a radical minority of the super-rich has gained ascendancy over politics, buying the policies, laws, tax breaks, subsidies, and rules that consolidate a permanent state of vast inequality by which they can further help themselves to America's wealth and resources. You bet. Democratic governance has been replaced by the sovereignty of the market, paving the way for modes of governance intent on transforming democratic citizens into entrepreneur agents. The language of the market and business culture have now almost entirely supplanted any celebration of the public good or the calls to enhance civil society's characteristic of past generations. Neoliberal governance has produced an economy and political system almost entirely controlled by the rich and the powerful. What a Citigroup report called a plutonomy, an economy powered by the wealthy. These plutocrats are what I've called the new zombies. They suck the resources out of the planet and the rest of us in order to strengthen their grasp on political and economic power and fuel their exorbitant lifestyles. Policies are not enacted that provide massive tax cuts to the rich and generous subsidies to banks or corporations alongside massive disinvestments in job creation programs and the building of critical infrastructures and the development of crucial social programs, which range from health care to school, meal programs for disadvantaged children. No, in reality, the massive disinvestment in school social programs and aging infrastructure is not about a lack of money. That is a lie. The real problem stems from government priorities that inform both the money is collected and how it is spent. Over 60% of the federal budget goes to the military-industrial complex. And did you hear President Obama disdain that amount of money and criticize it? Or did you hear Mitt Romney suggest anything other than he would keep it at that level? Is he that illiterate? Yes. Is he that indifferent? Absolutely. So who then speaks for us and takes this mega, gigantic, corrupt, inept military-industrial complex, larger than all the other militaries in the world combined, doubled, and says, this does not make us any safer? We give all of the benefits to those who are so powerful they need not take a penny from us, and we take the pennies from all those who desperately need it. In conclusion, at this time, the financialization of the economy and culture has resulted in the poisonous growth of monopoly power, predatory lending, abusive credit card practices, misuse of CEO pay, the false but central neoliberal tenet that markets can solve all of society's problems has no way of limiting power of money. And yet it gives rise to the politics in which policies that favor the rich have allowed the financial sector to amass vast economic and political power. As Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist from Columbia University, points out, there is more at work in this form of governance than a pandering to the wealthy and powerful. There is also the specter of an authoritarian society where people live in gated communities. Large segments of the population are impoverished or locked up in prison, and Americans live in a state of constant fear as they face growing economic insecurity, healthcare insecurity, and a sense of physical insecurity. In other words, the authoritarian nature of neoliberal political governance and economic power is also visible in the rise of a national security state in which civil liberties are being drastically abridged and violated. As the war on terror becomes a normalized state of existence, the most basic rights available to all of us are being shredded. The spirit of revenge, militarization, and fear now permeate the discourse for national security. Under Presidents Bush and Obama, the idea of habeas corpus, with its guarantee that prisoners have a minimum right, has been given way to policies of indefinite detention, abductions, targeted assassinations, drone killings, and expanded state surveillance apparatus. The Obama administration has designated 46 inmates for indefinite detention at Guantanamo because, not because they've been found guilty of anything, but rather because they consider them neither triable nor releasable. Moreover, another 167 men are now confined at Guantanamo who have been cleared for release. They were innocent of all crimes, yet they still remain prisoners. With the passing of the National Defense Authorization Act, the rule of legal illegalities has been extended to threatening the lives and rights of U.S. citizens. The law authorized military detention of individuals who are suspected of belonging not only to terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda, but to anything associated. As Glenn Greenwald pointed out, this grants the president the power to indefinitely detain in military custody not only accused terrorists, but also just about anyone else they choose. The vagueness of the law allows the possibility of subjugating U.S. citizens who are considered in violation of the law to indefinite detention. That could be journalists like Chris Hedges, writers, intellects, and anyone else who might be accused because they represent a threat to the status quo. How can we sit back and allow all this to happen? But we have, except for a small percentage of those who have been courageous enough to stand up and say, I'm not that dumb. I'm not that indifferent. I'm not that fearful. I'm not a coward. I'm a human being, and I will fight you. Henry Giroux, Truth Out. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Well, look at that, look at that, look at that, look at that. Ooh, wee. Look at that, look at that, look at that. Ooh, wee. Ooh, ah, ooh, wee. Well, she's so fine, fine, fine. She's so fine, fine. She's so fine, and she's so fine, fine, fine. She's really.
Gary Knoll. We're going to our guest now. Let's go over and say hello to Dr. Stephen Droecker. He is a public interest attorney and founder of the Alliance for Biointegrity, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing human and environmental health through sustainable and safe technologies. He was the instigator and initiator of a major and little-known lawsuit against the U.S. FDA over the approval of GMOs in violation of food federal safety codes. And he received tens of thousands of pages of FDA files proving illegal wrongdoing in favor of the biotech industry and Monsanto. And he is with us now. He is the author of Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, which details the lawsuit over GMOs and reveals the critical issues from the damaging documentation he received during the legal proceedings. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Many believe, as I do, that big agri corporations such as Monsanto and DuPont have known about the human, animal, and environmental risks of GMO all along. Not unlike the pharmaceutical industry, they only submit studies that favor their product's approval. I believe it's foolish to assume that the corporations honestly believe their genetically modified products are safe and that they're just happening to be stuck in a perverted scientific matrix or paradigm that we can excuse them for because they didn't know. What I'd like for you to share with us, based upon those documents you received, is what did they know? What do they know? And what has been covered up and with the full knowledge and complicity of the FDA? The form is yours. Take your time.
Well, the documents from the FDA's files that, again, many people feel that that they were obtained through Freedom of Information Act, we couldn't have gotten them that way. The FDA and the USDA have had a history of stonewalling public interest groups and others who have been trying to get information out of their files about how they've been developing their policies and practices on genetically engineered foods. We only got the 44,000-plus pages by suing the FDA and forcing them to hand it over through the discovery process. So unless a judge had have required it, we still wouldn't know what actually happened at the FDA. But now we do know, and we know that the FDA established a biotechnology task force back in the early 1990s to develop the scientific basis for their policy statement on genetically engineered foods. But something happened that the White House and that the politically appointed administrators did not like. The scientists at the FDA actually behaved as scientists. And as they reviewed the information that was known at that time about genetic engineering, they overwhelmingly concluded that genetic engineering cannot be in any way equated with traditional breeding, with any other form of plant breeding that has come before it, that it's a radical new technology, that it can create major disruptions, unpredictable changes throughout an organism, and that the resulting foods cannot be presumed safe, and that they entail a range of risks that are different than the risks from conventional breeding. Now, memo after memo is very clear on this, and the strength of the consensus within the FDA scientific staff is well attested by a memo from an FDA compliance officer whose duty it was to make sure the FDA was staying in compliance with the statutory law and its own regulations, who wrote a strong memorandum to the FDA's biotechnology coordinator in January of 1992, just a few months before the FDA released its policy statement on genetically engineered foods, protesting that the FDA was trying to force a square peg into a round hole by trying to force an ultimate conclusion that there is no difference between foods modified by genetic engineering and foods modified by traditional breeding practices. And then she continued, the processes of genetic engineering and traditional breeding are different, and according to the technical experts in the agency, they lead to different risks. Now, that was a quote from her memo, that these processes are different, and according to the technical experts in the agency, they lead to different risks. And she also highlighted the utter lack of evidentiary support for any presumption that genetically engineered foods are safe by demanding, are we asking the scientific experts to generate the basis for this policy statement in the absence of any data? So there wasn't any safety testing that had gone on that had been conducted on genetically engineered foods as of the end of 1991, or as of May of 1992, when the FDA issued its policy statement claiming that these foods are just as safe as their conventionally produced counterparts and that they don't need to be safety tested at all. Where did the FDA come up with the basis for that policy statement? Not from their own scientists and not from any scientific evidence, because the record shows there wasn't any, and the law demands that there should have been. The law, by the way, requires that every genetically engineered food should have been demonstrated safe through standard scientific procedures before it ever was allowed on the market. None of them have fulfilled the requirements of the law. So why are they on the market? because beginning with the Reagan administration, continuing through the first Bush administration, then through Clinton Gore, then through George W. Bush, and now with Barack Obama, every presidential administration has pushed genetically engineered foods, has had a policy to foster the U.S. biotechnology industry, and for years and years the FDA has acknowledged that it has an explicit policy to foster the biotech industry. And unfortunately, the FDA administrators put their allegiance to Monsanto, DuPont, Dow Chemical above their duty to protect the safety of our food supply and to uphold the law. They broke the law. They ignored the conclusions of their own scientists. They lied about the facts. They claimed in their policy statement of May of 1992 that they were not aware of any information showing that genetically engineered foods differ in any uniform or meaningful way from foods produced by any other means. That's a blatant lie. Their files were filled with such information from their own scientific staff. So they lied. They also claimed that there's an overwhelming consensus within the scientific community that genetically engineered foods are so safe they don't need to be tested, when they knew full well that the overwhelming consensus within their own scientific staff was just the opposite. That in alone shows these foods were on the market illegally. But the FDA's biotechnology coordinator had written a letter to a Canadian health official. By the way, copies of these key memos are on our website, www.biointegrity.org. Nobody has to take my word for it. In this letter, the FDA's biotechnology coordinator admitted there wasn't a consensus about safety in the scientific community outside the FDA either. So the FDA knew full well in May of 1992 that there was not a consensus about safety within the scientific community, and they knew that they did not have a shred of solid evidence generated through standard scientific testing showing that any genetically engineered food was safe, but they went ahead and claimed that they were anyway. A blatant lie and a blatant violation of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and the agency's own regulations. How have they been getting away with it? Well, first, nobody knew the extent of the fraud up until our lawsuit pried open their files. But since that time, I have presented this evidence, solid evidence, to the major newspapers, major broadcasters, and even though reporters were very interested, and even sometimes lower-level producers, the higher-ups would not let this evidence get through. So article after article was censored and shredded by editors and rewritten, or broadcasts for major news corporations have been edited out so that all that evidence was gone. All of my quotes from the FDA files edited out. So that's the kind of, unfortunately, it's because of big media as well that Americans have been kept in the dark. And my book is bringing out all of this evidence and much more. As you mentioned, its title is Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. The subtitle is How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. And the FDA's fraud is not the only fraud. It's the main fraud. But the mainstream scientific community has been committing fraud after fraud in getting these foods out and sustained on the market. And as I said, the mainstream media have been pliant accomplices in the cover-up and the fraud. So it's not a pretty picture, but it's a picture that needs to be painted. We have to, our public has to know this. American citizens have to wake up.
Stephen, let me intercept a seat here for a moment. We're going to be saying goodbye to many of our land-based stations, ending the 55-minute segment of the program. However, we're going to continue for the next 10 minutes with my guest to explore more information that he has from his files in the lawsuit against the FDA. And I'm going to ask him specifically about sharing with us some of the more outrageous, heinous activities of the FDA and regulatory health and food officials that he uncovered, and also what are some of the tactics used by the FDA supporting their corporate partners like Monsanto to subvert scientific voices, such as those eminent biologist Philip Regal, who was one of your co-plaintiffs. You can continue listening to this program by dialing 832-280-3295, 832-280-3295, or listening online at progressiveradionetwork.com. Stephen, for those of you who have to say goodbye and can't continue, his book is very important, and you can pick it up just about anywhere. And also his website, let me just give you that information. It's Stephen Droecker, D-R-U-K-E-R, Alder Genes, Twisted Truth. The website is biointegrity.org. Now, Stephen, for the next 10 minutes, we'll run a little bit into Yatrice Leeds' program that follows us, but she'll still have time for her full 55-minute show. Please address these two issues, if you would. What were the worst, and heinous activities of the FDA? What evidence did you see how bad the genetic modified industry has? What have they done? What can you present us? And especially people like Monsanto that and others that where you can offer a challenge of how they subverted scientific voices.
Yes, well, I won't be able to do it all in 10 minutes. The book does it thoroughly, but I've already shared with you some of the very bad things the FDA has done, the lies they've told, covering up evidence, covering up all the information from their own scientists, and then saying they weren't aware of any such information. It's very clear, Gary, that while the scientists were protesting as the drafts of the policy statement were being put together, the scientists were saying, you're taking out all the scientific information we're giving you. But, of course, it was being taken out because it was damaging. Now, who were the FDA administrators listening to? We see, again, in the FDA files, memos coming from Office of Management and Budget telling them to how to phrase the policy statement. People in the OMB are telling them how to phrase scientific statements to make them look good for genetically engineered foods, taking out things that will create the wrong impression that these foods are somehow different, even though that is scientific reality. So you can see the memos coming from the higher-ups in HHW and the White House, they got listened to. Also, what the FDA did in the summer of 1991 to make sure that the policy statement was sped along the proper lines and that the FDA scientists could not derail it, put it on a track of sound science and truth, the FDA did something rather extraordinary. It created a new position, deputy director for policy, and this new administrator was put primarily in charge of developing the policy statement on genetically engineered foods. And funnily enough, the FDA selected for this position a lawyer with a major Washington, D.C. law firm who was representing Monsanto and the International Biotechnology Council. So we know what his predilections were. By the way, he had been an FDA attorney for the earlier part of his career. Then he went through the revolving door, went into private practice representing the industries that he had been regulating. Then he got back into the FDA to put out a policy tailor-made. And it's kind of a pun. His name is Michael Taylor, and this policy was tailor-made in several respects for the tastes of Monsanto, because basically it requires nothing. Genetically engineered foods are completely deregulated when it comes to the safety issue, when it comes to the FDA. Somebody can dump genetically engineered foods on our market without even notifying the FDA that they're doing it. And that's how permissive the policy is. When we brought out our lawsuit, the FDA spokespeople joined the chorus of of apologists for the GM industry, genetic engineered industry, in trying to poo-poo our lawsuit. And one FDA senior analyst at the FDA was quoted, and this went out through many papers, that our claim for labeling was like demanding that table grapes picked by non-union labor have to be labeled as picked by non-union labor. But that's how superficial the differences are between genetically engineered foods and the conventional counterparts, the same as if they were just picked by non-union as opposed to union labor. I mean, and that man knows far differently. He's a scientist. But that's the kind of scamming that has been going on. That's the kind of level to which our government officials in the FDA and other bureaus have stooped to push these foods on us and to completely hoodwink the public. And they've done a very good job of it. Polls have showed most Americans still don't even realize they've been eating genetically engineered foods for about 15 years now. Americans are regularly ingesting these foods without even knowing it.
Stephen, two other quick answers. If you could give me short answers, I'd appreciate it now.
Sure.
What do you think of the Monsanto and the genetic engineering industry hitting back against the French scientists for showing that after 90 days, tumors began to appear, and the older the rats were, the more the tumors appear, and massive tumors, mammary tumors, and renal tumors in the mice. And these are the same rats that are used by all the other industries, and attacking them, and then also attacking the Scottish scientists, in fact, attacking everybody who has a credible, independent scientific background that shows concern about GMO crops.
I think it's regrettable but fully predictable because, as you said, Monsanto, the industry, and their enablers within academia have attacked every independent scientist who has brought out a study that has shown anything that could be wrong with genetically engineered foods, that has cast any doubt on genetically engineered foods. These people have been censured, ostracized. If they didn't have tenure, they have not been given tenure. If they had tenure, they've been shunned, and they don't get grant money anymore. It's not just Monsanto. It's our government, too. Grant funds get cut off. It's really a great travesty that's happening, and it's probably the biggest scientific fraud in history, that the people really trying to do the science on this are the ones that are being presented as irresponsible, and the scientists who are being irresponsible, who are spin doctoring, who are covering up bad data, they're the ones who are paraded as the sound, respectable scientists who we should listen to. And my book goes into this in great detail, too, of the fraud of the mainstream scientific community, including the National Academy of Sciences.
Okay, but, hold on 1 second. I've got to keep my – we only have a few moments left.
Okay.
Talk about how the most important scientific body in America, the National Academy of Sciences, has come down on the wrong side of history and truth when it comes to GMO and supporting it, and then do the same thing about the American media not being able – to free itself and do the truth story as you have already shown us?
Well, the National Academy of Sciences has, from the beginning of genetic engineering, favored it and tried to keep out, like in the early days, when ecologists were warning about many potential environmental hazards, even before foods were developed, the National Academy would not let there be a full scientific analysis and debate, including ecologists, because they were afraid the molecular biologists who were developing this they wanted them to keep control. The molecular biologists were able to set the agenda for the National Academy of Sciences, and the National Academy has not allowed a free and open scientific analysis and debate on this issue. My book details this quite thoroughly, and there are many, many instances over the years where the National Academies have not done their duty, not upheld strong science. The media, as I've mentioned, the media has basically in many ways blacked out any negative information about genetically engineered food. It's surprising that they've actually given coverage to the recent studies that you mentioned coming out of the University of Caen in France about these tumors that were developing in the long-term safety studies, because usually they don't report that either. But they're giving much greater coverage to the scientists who were pushing back against that and trying to discredit all of that research. And I think we can expect that they will continue to present an imbalanced picture. But we know that the U.S. media, the mainstream media now, even now, has not reported the FDA fraud. And I released all that information in June of 1999 at a major press conference in Washington, D.C. And my book has a whole chapter documenting the media suppression of that information.
Stephen, I have one last question to you. Stephen,
sure.
One last question. Bill Gates, major supporter of Monsanto and genetic engineering. Hillary Clinton, major supporter of GMOs, and as is the State Department, the USDA and the FDA. They're giving a lot of false claims and lies out there. Challenge them, please. You, let's say you have Bill Gates and Hillary Clinton in front of you, the head of the FDA and USDA in front of you. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say read the evidence that's in my book. Because if Bill Gates actually read that instead of hearing from the people who were feeding, you know, he has so many ex-Monsanto people working at the Gates Foundation developing his agricultural initiatives, I'd say to Hillary, your main advisor, the main scientific advisor you had for many years, who also was a member of the National Academy of Sciences, my book shows how she's making misrepresentation after misrepresentation to the New York Times in her book, published by an arm of the National Academy of Sciences, outright misstatements. In fact, she misstates some basic facts about biology. So that's what I would say is get the facts, stop listening to the spin doctors, even though they have fancy degrees.
I appreciate you sharing your insights with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Steve Droeker, author of Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, website biointegrity.org. All the best to you.
Thank you, and same to you.
I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for listening and sharing this time with us.
My heart is crying, crying.